Well, it's a real pleasure having the chance to talk to you. I've been reading your books for many, many years and enjoying them. And, you know, some people have heroes. They're rock stars and they're movie stars. And my heroes happen to be authors, especially authors like you. I want to ask you some things about yourself. But first, I was reading 6 Days in Havana. What a wonderful, what a beautiful book, and it's an interesting story about how this book came about, because one of the interesting things, it's not published by your regular publisher. Tell me how 6 Days in Havana came about.
I have been working for 3 years on a long book on the Caribbean, and I'd been on all the islands in the Caribbean that I wanted to visit, almost all of them, whether I wanted to visit or not, excepting the two major ones, Jamaica and Cuba. And I really had to see Cuba after I got to see Jamaica, because it did leave a gap. And I wanted to write about certain specific situations in Cuba, a house that I wanted to describe, and a sugar factory. And so after 3 years of fruitless trial, I got a passport to go to Cuba, got a visa, and from our government, and accepted by them. And belatedly, very late in the day, I slipped in.
Well, what is the rule now? Can tourists go into Cuba at will?
No, they cannot. Mm-hmm. Not American tourists. Now, you understand that there are a lot of European tourists in Cuba, and especially a lot of Canadians, because they can go. Our government will not allow us to go, because we take dollars into the Cuban economy, and in a sense, our government says we help communism. I could go, but my wife couldn't go. Because I could go as a writer, as a professional. She would have to go as a tourist, and she was forbidden to do that.
I understand that there's only one flight a day from the U.S.?
That is right. It's a mysterious flight. Takes off almost surreptitiously at about 1:30 in the morning from a corner of the Miami airport, so there can't be a lot of exhibitionism and displays and protests. And you fly down, it takes only 38 minutes from Miami to Havana, and it lands, loads in a hurry, and flies back about 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's it, and nobody knows about it.
Now, when you arrived in Havana, you didn't have a particularly warm welcome, did you, as you write in 6 Days in Havana?
No. That was the only unpleasant part of the whole visit. They're very suspicious. He would be a devout communist, I suppose, or he wouldn't have the job at the customs office in Havana. And he looked at me with great suspicion, especially since I didn't have a place to stay, which you're supposed to have before you come. I was going to stay with an official of the United States government. He didn't want to know about that either. But then I was rescued by a friend who saw me on the other side of the barrier. And I must say that I didn't take objection to that. It was, you know, a diplomatic hassle. Happens everywhere.
You expect a little surliness in the third world anyway, don't you?
Yes, you do. Suspicion, especially Mr. Castro, you know, hammers at us all the time. There are big bulletin boards all over Havana proclaiming that we're the eternal enemy, and the public doesn't seem to believe it. We had a great time with the public, but it's a tense situation.
Now, you went with John King, your collaborator, is that right?
John has been my office manager and guru for quite a few years. He's worked with me quite often, and he's far more than just a friend. He's a very sharp, knowledgeable editor himself, and he went with me, and he took a camera. I didn't even realize it, and sometimes I'd look around, and there would be John banging away three for a minute, and he came home with this flood of wonderful photographs.
Yes, he has taken photographs of you in all sorts of locations in Havana. One thing that struck me as I was reading the book and looking at the photographs, it looks as though Cuba is caught in a kind of a time warp.
We arrived about 3 o'clock in the morning. It took us about an hour and a half to get through, something like that. And our plane had been late. Normally it gets there earlier, but we were late. And my first impression as we drove through the sort of silvery pre-dawn dusk was that what Havana needed was about 1 million gallons of white paint. And then also 100,000 lawnmowers. It's shabby. It's sad. I know they don't want it to be that way. I mean, these are just as self-respecting people as you or I, but the government can't provide them with any of those things.
Looking at the photographs, I see all of these cars with the big fins from the 1950s. It looks like time has stopped.
Somebody told me something that is quite true, that the day negotiations are reopened between Cuba and the United States, some bright characters are going to go down there with a barge and buy up all the cars they see, bring them back here, redo them. They're going to sell them as antique wonders. It's about, you know, time warp is a good word. It's about 48, 50 years back.
They make a fortune in Edsels.
Well, they tell me that some of the best auto mechanics in the world are in Havana, and body men. They can make anything. They recast flywheels. They redo fins. Fins are real big in Cuba today, believe me. These great gas-guzzling monsters go through the streets. You think you're back in the 1950s.
There's one strikingly sad photograph, or a number, but the one in particular stands out that John King's took. It's a photograph of a department store, and all of the counters are empty.
I went through 3 of the great department stores. Let's say Macy's and Gimbel's and Bloomingdale's, the comparable. And on the ground floor, which most department stores, you know, they have little kiosks where you sell perfume and you sell stockings and maybe you sell men's ties. Each one has some one thing. Of the 30 that I saw in their biggest store, 20 of them were totally empty. Nothing in them. The other 10 each had some one thing in one color and 3 sizes, big, medium, and little. And that was it. And that's a gaping. That's like a one-time pretty girl smiling with the 3 front teeth missing. It oughtn't to happen. A store ought to have things for sale. Now, they don't have to be imported from Rome the way they would be in say, Macy's. They don't have to be, you know, top-dollar things from Tokyo. They could be things made locally or things imported from Miami or from Atlanta. But when you don't have anything, not even local produce, it's quite sad, really. I felt great sorrow. One thing that I learned, which was quite painful to me, there was no toilet paper. Okay, there was no toilet paper. There was no toothpaste. Okay, no toothpaste. There was no makeup for young women, or no pretty clothes. At the very time, you know, when they're 17 and 18 and 19 and 20, when they're trying to define who they are and what they are and what their relationship is with young men, girls ought to have an opportunity to be pretty at that time. Men can get away without a tie or without a shirt, but girls have, and to have nothing there, nothing, no perfume, no anything. It was quite painful to me.
That must relate to a trade embargo imposed by the U.S.
Yes, yes. Now, it's interesting. There's a lot of U.S. goods there. They slip in surreptitiously through Mexico. And they were highly prized. They have American movies. I wouldn't like to even guess how they get them, but they're very popular. They might bring them in through Puerto Rico or slip them in through Brazil or something. There's a subterranean exchange. They get American television sometimes, and then they get American radio all the time. So there is an interchange. And they love things American.
John King's photographs of you show you with the people. Apparently, the Cubans are very approachable.
I would like to bear testimony to the fact that I was there for 6 days, traveling very widely, on my own. Nobody was taking me around. I had a car and a driver. I determined where we would go. I determined where we would stop. I determined whom we would speak to. I speak some Spanish. And wherever I went, I met the greatest warmth in the people. They wanted to talk to Americans. Now, Castro tells them again and again that we are the evil geniuses, and they've got to fear us as enemies, but not the individual. They know that that we have been their friends. I think everybody I met in Cuba wanted to get aboard an airplane and do some shopping in Miami or Atlanta or New York or someplace. There is that old friendship, remembered friendship. And I found proof of that wherever I went.
In literary terms, how did your visit to Havana pay off with relationship to Caribbean?
Yes. I had, as I say in the book, prior to going, assumed I was not going to get in. And I had read an enormous amount of material about Cuba, modern Cuba and historic Cuba also. I think I knew my, I think I knew Havana pretty well. I knew where it was and things. However, a writer like me is terribly imprisoned by real things. He's subject to error if he doesn't see them for himself. And no amount of reading could give me the view of real Havana, the desolation of the real estate at some times, the great mansions given over to rats and bats, lack of amenities. So I went down looking for a house in which my hero, about whom I'd already written and defined, he and his wife would be living in 1951. That is before Castro came. I had no idea what it was like. And I also wanted to see a sugar mill. Although I'm almost a world expert on sugar. Unfortunately, it's beet sugar. I used to live in Colorado right next to one of the top beet sugar mills in the world. I mean within a city block. So the smell of sugar beets is in my nose. I don't know much about cane sugar. And I had to go see that. I was allowed to see both to great profit. But it was very funny. The sugar beet factory was a disappointment. It wasn't in operation. It was, we were there in November, I guess.
Yeah, you're talking about the sugar cane factory.
The sugar cane factory was not in operation. And what I did see wasn't very helpful to me. But on the way, a man told me there was a great coffee plantation. Forget the sugar. Let's look at coffee. And it was the highlight of the whole trip. Just magnificent. And was an illustration of the point that a writer like me honestly never knows what he's looking for until he finds it. So going down to see a sugar plantation was entirely wrong. I should have gone down just to see what was doing. And the coffee plantation was epochal. It was just a magnificent thing. A ruin of the old days of about 1880 with the slave barracoons there, with a whole picture of what Spanish Cuba was like. Unforgettable.
Were you able to alter the text you had already written to reflect your visit to Cuba?
No, I stayed with a sugar plantation, but a modified one which I found closer to Havana, which was probably the one that my characters would have been in anyway. I used the coffee plantation as a flashback. It's just too good to lose, and we get a picture of it, but only as a flashback.
By the way, did you pay tribute to Hemingway while you were there?
You know, one of the warmest things about my visit to Cuba was the tremendous affection all of people in Cuba hold for Ernest Hemingway. His finca sort of a country place, F-I-N-C-A, Finca, is, you know, a short distance from Havana on the Atlantic coast, I believe. I could be. I think it's the Atlantic coast. A little seaport there, near there. And his house is just a shrine. They keep it with painful attention. They have professional curators who look after it. It is damaged a little bit by mildew. The temperature is pretty high there, and the moisture is high. But it's a shrine. And you can see Ernest coming down in his big floppy drawers and, you know, the kind he used, and T-shirt and a funny hat and heavy shoes. He just comes out of the door to greet you. It's a tribute to the friendship between Cuba and the United States. And we didn't do it. They did it. They revere this man. He was their friend. They recognized him as a great writer. They helped him. They gave him refuge when he needed it. And when the day comes that tourism returns to Cuba, American tourism, a trip to his place out of Havana will be one of the highlights of the Caribbean.
I have a feeling that our relationship with Cuba, the bad relationship between the governments of Cuba and the United States, has become kind of custom. We're almost used to it. Isn't that true?
Yes. I was constantly perplexed by the anomaly of the fact that I, as a respectable writer I don't throw my weight around and I don't write lurid things and I don't try to badmouth people, was not able to go to a country right on my doorstep. When President Reagan was allowed to go to Moscow and walk arm in arm with Gorbachev through the Kremlin and out in the public squares and meet the people, we ought to be doing that with Cuba. On our terms, we don't want communism. We're not going to allow him to get away with the things he's saying or do anything about it. But the simple fact is that that island is there with all those people and all those problems, and it's going to be on our doorstep. And we at least ought to have our diplomats there feeling things out, our businessmen visiting and checking things out. Do it on our terms, but I do think we ought to do it.
Now, 6 Days in Havana was published by the University of Texas Press in Austin.
Yes.
Yeah, that's your home base now, isn't it, Austin?
It is, yes. I have, for the last 3 years, I've been working in Miami, which is an absolutely fascinating place, as you know. Everything's happening in Miami. Gun running and wonderful sports and delightful people an American city slowly becoming an Hispanic city in so many ways. And recently elected an Hispanic woman to the Congress, taking the place of Claude Pepper. And I would suppose that those seats will become Hispanic permanently, as they should, because they are now the dominant people in the city. Well, I loved Miami as a place where things were happening. When I go to New York City, I like to stay around Times Square. I want to see what's happening. And I'm the same way about the United States. I don't want to be at some corner that's forgotten. I want to be where the action is. And right now the action is in Miami, tremendously so.
So when you research a book, you actually go to the scene as close as possible, isn't that right?
Yes. In all of the writing I've done, I've always been there. I've never written about a place I haven't been. And with two exceptions, I've always lived there. Rented a house or bought a house and dug in for 2 or 3 years. And the two exceptions were South Africa, where I went, I think, 5 times. And I knew South Africa very well. I was there many times in all corners of the country and enjoyed it enormously and saw the great tragedies that there experiencing. And Poland was a little too tough. I couldn't find a house in Poland. But I was in Poland, I think, 12 times. All the other places, I rent a house or buy a house and live there. I want to read the newspapers. I want to listen to the talk radio, the chatter. I want to look at television. I want to know what the weather is. I want to know what the economic problems are. And I especially want to know what's irritating the people. You can only do that by living there.
I understand that you have an extremely keen memory, that when you start to research a book and you do your research, you actually have a great sense of recall. Is that true?
Yes. I think I'm not unusual. I think many lawyers can do what I do. They must remember many cases. The clergymen remember the Bible, and newspaper editors remember facts. I am like that. I'm that kind of person. And I apparently have an unusual memory, because when I zero in on something, I really remember 300 or 400 books, where everything is in them. I don't take many notes. In the back of the book, I'll take page numbers, and maybe one word indicate that that's a page I ought to go back to. Now, I've done this, 12 or 14 times, and all sorts of subject matter, so I know I can do it. When it's done, I have the capacity to erase it almost completely. If you ask me today for the names of five good books on Hawaii, I would just look at you. I mean, so what? Now, when I finished Hawaii, I could have taught graduate course in a university in the country. Same with South Africa, same with Poland. But you can't keep it all in your brains. You'd go nuts. And so when it's done, I start to erase it.
I was talking to William Manchester a while ago. He had written a wonderful memoir about his Marine combat days in the South Pacific. And I referred to a section of the book and a character in the book, and he looked at me blankly.
Yeah.
He said, "No, that didn't happen, and there's no such character." And I flipped through the book, and I found it, and I read him a paragraph. It was a battle scene.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden he said, "Oh, that's right, I did write that." And he said, "I changed names." And that's when you mention the name of the character, it wasn't apparent to me, because I changed the names of the real people. And for some reason, I'd just forgotten that I had written that scene. It's almost the same thing, isn't it?
Yes,
you can,
it is.
You can go back
Absolutely.
To a book of your own. Is it though you have actually written this book, or someone else?
Let me say two things about that. Sometimes I have a very painful experience in a dentist's office or a doctor's office or someplace where I'm waiting, and someone will come up with a book for me to autograph, and I will leaf through it idly. And it's quite painful, because in the first page I will see things that could have been done better. Why did I slop that up? And then I'll turn a page and there will be a passage that's really just gorgeous. I have no memory of having written that one. The bad one I remember. The good one, no. It was sort of automatic, I think, that I was on a roll, and now out comes this great paragraph. And to think that I couldn't do it all the time is rather hurtful. Thank God I don't do all the bad ones all the time. But I don't like to reread my stuff. And if you came to me today with having just read The Source, which is a long one, maybe one of my best books, and asked me about some of the characters, I would just look at you blank. Where did you get that name?
Pulling a Manchester, I think it's called.
Yeah, I would be the same with me.
Well, we were talking about Hemingway a moment ago. I was reading a biography of Hemingway, and he would have difficulty with his manuscript. He would be so close to it that he would often put the manuscript down for months and months and go back to it.
Yes.
And try to read it as though he were an outside person and not the person who actually wrote that thing. Does that help at all, to put your manuscript aside and then go back and try to look at it freshly?
Well, now look, if I write a long book of say, 14 and 16 chapters, and each one is a sort of a novella in its own, it's obvious that I can't work at them all at the same time. I try to work in chronological order. I don't always. But if at the beginning of 2 years I write one, get it in pretty good shape and put it aside, I can't get back to that for 2 years. And by the time I get back to it, it needs a lot of work.
When you start to work on a book like Caribbean, and this is a mammoth book, do you make an outline? How do you approach the technical aspect of writing once you have done the research?
You won't believe this, but I can prove it. I kick the idea around. Let's say I finish. Well, right now I'm between books. So I have eight or nine real good ideas that have brooded in my mind for many years. And when I look at them real closely, maybe some of them aren't so hot, but I still have two or three. And I kick them around, and then one day I say, okay, Bub, this is it. For better or for worse, this is one we're going to do. And then I work on it for about a year, and find out the background and make outlines and do a whole lot of work. And then one day I say, okay, this, now we go. And that day I sit at my typewriter and put the date in the upper right-hand corner and type out how I felt about this project and why I had settled on it. And then I outline it on one sheet of paper, the 14, 15 chapters. I never get them all right. I never get more than one wrong. I always have one that doesn't work out, and I always miss one that I should have had in, so I know there's a change. Through of the 14 chapters, I get 13 of them right on the nose. But I've been working on it for a long time. And then I indicate what time period, who the principal characters are, about four lines for each one. And I do it in two columns, so four lines. That's about 60 lines. And there's the book. Now, all you didn't need to do then is to write the darn thing, and that takes a long time.
You actually got off to a late start as a writer, didn't you? You were 40 when Tales of the South Pacific was published. That's an interesting story about how that book came about, because you were serving in the Navy in the South Pacific. What motivated you to begin your career as a writer at this time?
I was one of the oldest men, quite possibly I was the oldest man drafted. I fell afoul of a rascally man in my draft board who had a vengeance against me and threw me in. I was exempt on two counts. I was too old and I was a Quaker. I was exempt from the war. But I saw Hitler and Tojo as national enemies, and I volunteered. I was ready to go. And I was drafted into the Army, and there was a report on Friday, and on Thursday I said, boy, I'd rather go to war in a warship than hike, and so I joined the Navy that afternoon. And I went in as an enlisted man and came out after a long time as a very junior officer, and I went out to the South Pacific, and I had two complete tours of duty because they found out I had been an historian, and they made me a historical officer for the South Pacific. So I had two, I was in the South Pacific a long time. So I was older than most, and I served longer than most. And out of it came these stories of men in combat and men not in combat, and the natives and the interplay between the natives and the sailors. It was a vivid experience. But I think more basic than that is, if you put a man 36 years old in full flight in his career, doing pretty well, rip him out of it and throw him out there, this is traumatic. It's a much greater shock than for a kid 18 years old this is his first big experience. It's not my first big experience. I had a lot of good ones, and here's this enforced 3 years, 4 years, and it changes you. It really does. And I represented a great many people. Many men like me said, when I go back, I don't want to do what I did before. I want to be a professor. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a doctor. And a great many of them said, I want to be a clergyman. I want to deal with the great problems of right and wrong. And And a lot of them said, I want to be a politician. I want to clean this thing up. And we are that generation, I and all my friends of that age group, who decided we could do better than we had done before. And thanks to the wonderful program of the government of GI Bill, we were able to get an education and do better. And it's a great tribute to the United States Congress that they had the courage to pass that GI Bill. Give all those young men and women a free education, and so they will contribute something to the government.
Well, you began writing these stories, but I have a feeling that you may have been tentative as a writer. Of course, right now you are in full authority and command of your craft, but when you start, I think every writer starts in a tentative way. Isn't that true?
A very tentative, believe me. The average writer writes his or her first three books at 4 o'clock in the morning while fulfilling a complete job, 9-to-5 job. Now, you might write, depending upon your character, you might write 11-to-3 and then go to bed. I got up at 4 and worked till 7. And if you're not willing to do that, you're not going to be a writer. You're not going to meet the competition. Unless you marry a very wealthy person and let somebody else pay the bill. No, you have a full job. Very demanding job. And yet you have this driving compulsion to tell stories and share experience and get it all down on paper. That's what we do. And I had that driving compulsion. I love to tell stories, to organize material and tell you how things really were. I'm a storyteller.
You certainly are. You submitted these stories to Macmillan. You had been working there as a textbook editor.
Yes.
But apparently they liked the stories. They published them. That was your first published book, I believe, 1947, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Yes.
And yet, at the same time, they were ambivalent. I mean, they valued you as an editor, and they liked your stories. Didn't they give you some sort of ultimatum, either work as a textbook editor or write?
That is right. Well, my second book, Macmillan turned down. They turned it down the week before my first book won a Pulitzer Prize. They said, you have no future as a writer. That was a war story, and that was it. But you are a really splendid editor, which I tried to be. They offered me a very flattering job in the publishing end. And I felt that my second book did have something to say. So I got aboard a bus and went up town right near here and got off the bus and took it into Random House and said, I got a manuscript here, all done. Do you want to publish it? And they said, we'd love to. A few days later, I got the Pulitzer Prize.
By the way, I wasn't near here. This building is perched on top of Random House. This is like old stomping grounds for you, isn't it?
That is right. When I come to the Helmsley Palace and just look out my window, I can see the remnants of the building in which I worked for many years and where I had a wonderful friendship with Bennett Cerf and some of his editors and some of his playboys. It's a great area here I'm in. This is my hometown around here.
Well, it took a certain degree of courage to quit a successful job. I mean, I believe your first novel or your first book received an advance of $500, and you wonder, how am I going to live? I mean, doesn't that take a certain degree of courage for one to give up the safety of a job and explore uncharted territory like that?
I am a freelance. It's a noble profession. There aren't too many of us around. I have no assurance from anybody. I have no paid vacations. I have no retirement pay. I have no medical care. I have nothing but what I do myself. And I have a most enviable job. And a great many of my friends, upwards of a dozen or more, have wanted to do what I do. And they all had the talent to do it. But they couldn't risk that 2 years without a paycheck. Usually it was their wives who couldn't risk it. They would get very nervous. And all of my friends, many of whom I helped get jobs and assignments and everything else, they all went back to a salary because the nervous tension of being a freelance is just too tough. Now, I don't want to sound like a hero because even with my good start, I didn't have the guts to become a freelance until about 4 years later. I didn't go right out and say, boy, I'm the cock of the walk. I was very antsy about doing it. And I consulted some old-timers in the business, some old writers, and I learned what the difficulties were. And I did, however, feel that having worked as an editor, I knew what books were. And having lived a pretty tough life, I knew that I didn't quit easily. And very belatedly, I wrote the book in 45, published it in 46. I really edited in 46, published it in 47, and didn't make the break until, I think, 51.
Of course, you had a certain degree of ammunition with you, the Pulitzer Prize. That must have been a very heady experience winning that for your first book.
But the first book never did anything. It was never a bestseller. I had a $500 advance. I think maybe it was $300, maybe it was $500, and I earned about $500 more, and that was about it. So I wasn't in the lap of luxury at all. Of course, when the play came along at in 49, then I had a small monthly income, never very large, but enough to pay the rent, pay the insurance policy. So I did have something that other writers didn't have. I did have that anchor to windward, you would say, in a storm.
Last night I was listening to the new recording of South Pacific. You know, they have a new version of it, and
Kiri Takanawa and the English group.
And I was listening to Bali High, and I got this chill, the shudder. I just wonder if you, when you hear Bali High, knowing that you, in a way, inspired that song, don't you get that chill kind of?
Some 14 of my stories have been made into movies or great plays or television things, and I've never been associated with any one of them. I'm a writer of words and books, and I leave the drama to other people who have talent in that direction. I don't. But I'm terribly proud of something like South Pacific or Sayonara or especially Bridges of Toko Ri. These are sterling statements, and the long television serial about the building of the West. I've been well treated by the media, and I get a kick out of it. I'm glad that other people took the trouble to do those great things. And South Pacific is especially moving. I knew Pinza well. I was in love with Mary Martin. She's an absolutely adorable person. I knew all of the actors pretty well, and had a great affection for Juanita Hall. Mm-hmm. I was her close friend when she was dying. So it's not just casual. I've known these people. And to see them on stage in their glory is quite a wonderful thing. And to see it, that it all came out of what I had written, is a magical feeling, yes.
You look very robust, but you had heart surgery a couple of years ago. That must be grist for the writer's meal, isn't it?
I'm among the walking wounded. I've had a major heart attack, which wipe out most men, and I have had a coronary bypass, a quintuple, which is one of the worst. I've had a new hip. I've had been knocked around, and I love it. I mean, it goes with the territory. And we have great doctors these days, and they perform miracles. I would suppose that I'd been born 100 years earlier, I would have been dead at age 45, 46. Penicillin has kept me alive several times, and the great new sulfa drugs are simply miraculous. These operations I've been through, you know, to take out the heart and redo it and to put in a whole new leg, it's quite spectacular, you know. And it hasn't bothered me a bit. I take myself very carefully, very seriously. I do what the doctors say. But from the time that I was declared nearly dead till today, I forget when it happened, says 64 maybe, I have written, you know, these 7 or 8 great books. I've worked in the north of the Arctic Circle, and when I was past 80, I've traveled around the world 8 or 10 times. I go everywhere. I do everything. But I sure take care of myself.
Well, I have a feeling that James Michener is not going to go into retirement. He's not going to retire to a retirement village at any time soon. What new projects are you planning?
When I finish a book, I have about 7 or 8 great ideas kicking around in my mind. My mind is as fertile as a child's dream of glory. I just think of things all the time. So I have 7 or 8 great ideas I'd like to tackle. And upon closer inspection, some of them aren't so hot. You drop them. You know, I've started several things I never finished. I've not had a clear sail by any means. So I'm a little scary. A little gun-shy. But then, as I say one day, I say, okay, bub, this is it. And I pick one of the 2 or 3 goodies, and I never look back, never second-guess or anything like that. I fail sometimes, but I don't surrender.
Well, you've wrapped up Caribbean. Have you left Miami now? Have you packed up?
Yes. It's very interesting. We're here in New York to help a great Japanese opera company open its schedule here in New York. People I've known for 40 years and for which I have great affection. And when we're through on Friday, I go to Texas to resume my work there with the university. And my wife goes back to Miami to close down our home there. And then we will be in Texas for the foreseeable future. We will try to find some place to live, maybe a kind of retirement home which has health services and so on. Retire? No, I as long as I can get my 2 fingers on a typewriter, I type the old-fashioned way with a manual typewriter. But I ain't stupid, because as soon as I get it done, I give it to my very bright secretary, and she puts it on a floppy disk.
Yeah,
and we edit on a floppy disk.
Yeah, I was wondering, as I was going through Caribbean and looking at the size of it, I just wondered, a typewriter? I mean, how can you do that on a typewriter today?
No, wait, dear friend. You look at that, and I typed much of it 3 times to get it right. I type it about 3 times before I put it on the floppy disk. And then we just kick the heck out of it. And then when I send it to New York, they kick the heck out of it. And then we send it out to bright people, and they kick it around. But as a result, I'm a little different from some writers. I seek advice of bright people, and then all of my books are still in print. They're all doing well. They're all stables. I work terribly hard, but so do other people, my publishers. And it's been a... it's been a life of very hard work, but quite wonderful, really.
Oh, it's you certainly have a distinguished career. Your books are wonderful. They have entertained and enlightened people all over the world, and we'll be reading them for years and years to come. Just one last question. You mentioned that you work with the University of Texas. What is your relationship with the university?
My wife and I, she is a woman of Japanese descent, an American citizen. Was in a prison camp here during World War II, and she was taken out by good-minded people in American universities and given a college degree, and I was a boy without any prospects at all, and they found me and gave me a college degree. We love universities, and we love colleges, and we love the American system of education. So we give a great deal of our income back to colleges and universities, and I have been particularly interested in the writing profession, helping young people get started, and we have funded writing schools around the country and in three foreign countries, because that's just what we believe in. I think writing is one of the best professions in the world. And I want to see young people of ability take a shot at it, and we try to help them out. So I will be at Texas trying to inspire young writers, and after that I'll be somewhere else trying to do it.
Well, you're one of a kind, James Michener. Thank you very, very much for talking to me.
It's an honor to be with you today on this lovely autumn day. What a beautiful day.